My approach to the market was not as abstract as it sounds. It took an intensely personal, emotional form. Testing was closely associated with pain and success with relief. When I asserted that markets are always biased, I was giving expression to a deeply felt attitude. I had a very low regard for the sagacity of professional investors, and the more influential their position, the less I considered them capable of making the right decisions. My partner and I took a malicious pleasure in making money by selling short stocks that were institutional favorites. But we differed in our attitudes to our own activities. He regarded only the other participants' views as flawed, while I thought that we had as good a chance of being wrong as anyone else. The assumption of inherently flawed perceptions suited my self-critical attitude. Operating a hedge fund utilized my training in survival to the fullest. Using leverage can produce superior results when the going is good, but it can wipe you out when events fail to conform to your expectations. One of the hardest things to judge is what level of risk is safe. There are no universally valid yardsticks. Each situation needs to be judged on its own merit. In the final analysis, you must rely on your instincts for survival. Thus, my engagement in running a hedge fund brought together both my abstract interests and my practical skills. I did not play the financial markets according to a particular set of rules. I was always more interested in understanding the changes that occur in the rules of the game. I started with hypotheses relating to individual companies. With the passage of time, my interests veered increasingly toward macroeconomic themes. This was due partly to the growth of the fund and partly to the growing instability of the macroeconomic environment. For instance, exchange rates were fixed until 1973. Subsequently, they became a fertile field for speculation. For the past 4 or 5 years, I have had a growing sense of impending financial disaster. I felt that a long-lasting expansionary cycle was becoming increasingly unsound and unsustainable, and we were getting ready for a bust. That was one of the reasons I distanced myself from the active management of the fund in 1981 and reduced its overall level of exposure. My interest shifted from my own survival to the survival of the system. I made a study of the international debt problem and published some papers on the subject. I used the same theoretical framework as in my investment activities, and my analysis was not without merit. Unfortunately, the more complex the system, the greater the room for error. I made some mistakes in my analysis that detracted from the accuracy of my predictions. They also had a detrimental effect on my investment results until I revised my views in the course of writing this book. The more successful I had been in applying my ideas in financial markets, the keener I became to express them in theoretical form. I continued to cherish the fantasy that the concept of reflexivity constitutes a major contribution to our understanding of the world in which we live. I believed that the participant's bias is the key to an understanding of all historical processes that have thinking participants, just as genetic mutation is the key to biological evolution. But a satisfactory formulation of the theory of reflexivity continued to elude me. I always ran into trouble when I tried to define what I meant by the imperfect understanding of the participants. To speak accurately of a distortion, we must know what the situation would be if it were not distorted by the participants' perceptions. Unfortunately, that does not seem possible because the participants' thinking is an integral part of the situation they have to think about. It is not surprising that the concept of reflexivity should present extreme difficulties. If it were an easier concept to work with, economists and other social scientists would not have gone to such lengths to banish it from their subject matter. This book is a final attempt to explore the implications of reflexivity. I have tried to circumvent the difficulties I encountered in the past by approaching the subject from the opposite direction. Instead of getting bogged down in abstract theory, I am going to draw on my experimental, practical findings to the greatest possible extent. I cannot avoid an abstract discussion altogether, but I have confined it to a single chapter. In exploring the practical implications, I start with the simplest cases and gradually lead up to more complex ones. This approach happens to coincide with the historical order in which I encountered reflexive developments in practice. First the stock market, then the currency market, then the international debt problem, and finally what may be called the credit cycle. The stock market provides some pure examples of a boom and bust pattern. Freely floating currency rates allow me to explore well-formed wave patterns. The boom and bust in international bank lending is part of a more complex historical process of credit expansion and eventual credit contraction. It has given rise to the configuration that I have dubbed Reagan's Imperial Circle. The configuration prevailed from the international debt crisis of 1982 until the first half of 1985, but it was inherently unstable. How the instability will be resolved is one of the main questions considered in this book. The experimental approach has borne unexpected results. I made two major discoveries in the course of writing. One is a reflexive connection between credit and collateral. The other is a reflexive relationship between the regulators and the economy they regulate. It has long been assumed that monetary values are a passive reflection of the state of affairs in the real world. Classical economics focused on the real world and neglected the problems connected with money and credit. Even Keynes couched his general theory in real terms. Monetarists sought to stand the relationship on its head. They argue that it is possible to control inflation by controlling the growth of the money supply. In my opinion, all these views are based on a fundamental misconception. Money values do not simply mirror the state of affairs in the real world. Valuation is a positive act that makes an impact on the course of events. Monetary and real phenomena are connected in a reflexive fashion. That is, they influence each other mutually. The reflexive relationship manifests itself most clearly in the use and abuse of credit. Loans are based on the lender's estimation of the borrower's ability to service his debt. The valuation of the collateral is supposed to be independent of the act of lending. But in actual fact, the act of lending can affect the value of the collateral. This is true of the individual case and of the economy as a whole. Credit expansion stimulates the economy and enhances collateral values. The repayment or contraction of credit has a depressing influence both on the economy and on the valuation of the collateral. The connection between credit and economic activity is anything but constant. For instance, credit for building a new factory has quite a different effect from credit for a leveraged buyout. This makes it difficult to quantify the connection between credit and economic activity, yet it is a mistake to ignore it. The monetarist school has done so, with disastrous consequences. The reflexive interaction between the act of lending and collateral values has led me to postulate a pattern in which a period of gradual, slowly accelerating credit expansion is followed by a short period of credit contraction, the classic sequence of boom and bust. The bust is compressed in time because the attempt to liquidate loans causes a sudden implosion of collateral values. Economic history has been punctuated by booms and busts. Nevertheless, the concept of a credit cycle is too simplistic to explain the course of events. For one thing, the connection between credit and economic activity is too tenuous and variable to yield a regular pattern. For another, the sequence of events is greatly complicated by the influence of economic policy. Periodic busts have been so devastating that strenuous efforts have been made to prevent them. These efforts have led to the evolution of central banking and of other mechanisms for controlling credit and regulating economic activity. To understand the role of the regulators, it must be realized that they are also participants. Their understanding is inherently imperfect, and their actions have unintended consequences. The relationship between the regulators and the economy is reflexive, and it also exhibits cyclical characteristics in the sense that it tends to swing from one extreme to another. What is the connection between the regulatory cycle and the credit cycle? At this point, my views become very tentative. I believe that the two cycles broadly overlap in time, that the minimum of regulations tends to coincide with the maximum of credit expansion, and vice versa. But within this chronological coincidence, there is constant interaction between the two cycles that influences the shape and duration of both. The interaction between the two cycles yields a unique path that cannot be fitted into any regular or repetitive pattern. I should like to emphasize that this book is not meant to provide a practical guide to getting rich in the stock market. Most of what I know is in the book, at least in theoretical form. I have not kept anything deliberately hidden. But the chain of reasoning operates in the opposite direction. I am not trying to explain how to use my approach to make money. Rather, I am using my experiences in the financial markets to develop an approach to the study of historical processes in general and the present historical moment in particular. If I did not believe that my investment activities can serve that purpose, I would not want to write about them. As long as I am actively engaged in business, I would be better off to keep them a trade secret. But I would value it much more highly than any business success if I could contribute to an understanding of the world in which we live, or, better yet, if I could help to preserve the economic and political system that has allowed me to flourish as a participant.